I have been extolling the virtues of focusing, as you know, in the last two classes. I made one on the regular retreat last week at Vickering, and we've managed to persuade Sister Jane Galvin to do a couple of nights of introduction at Regis to the focusing practice. And so she will be here on Thursday, March 25th. And again on Thursday, April 1st at 7:30 in Elliott McGuigan Hall. And each of those will be an introductory kind of presentation in terms of explaining what the focus of technique is and the practice of it and the demonstration of it. It's very non-intrusive. You don't have to worry about any exposing anything that you're dealing with or anything like that, but you'll see that when she does a demonstration of it. You're welcome to attend either or both of those introductory sessions, and then if people wish to form small focusing groups, Jane will help those groups get started. The only thing that she's asking for is if people are able to give some kind of very modest free will offer for these evenings. She does need to take something away, but she's not specifying anything. Yeah. I highly recommend it, and in terms of, as I've mentioned to you, its connections with the whole Lonergan thing are very obvious. So, Lonergan himself was very supportive of Jen Lynn's work, and it's a way of coming into appropriation of elements of the first level, particularly of consciousness. Lonergan himself explicitly, in speaking to me, connected it to the psychic conversion that I was attempting to articulate. So it's connected with this course. It's connected with this course, not in the sense that students have to participate in it, but it's connected with the materials that will come. So I highly recommend it. Who knows what will come of it. It's a very helpful meditative practice that is now being used in spiritual direction and retreats. Very, very helpful. Very helpful. And very accessible.
Would it be the same introductory session or both?
I think she'll probably be doing pretty much the same thing in both of them. But it may, you know, we may see. She may get an idea after the first one that she might want to add something in the second, but she would let people know at that point that we're still looking at something more. So I'd like to direct your attention, if I could, to the notes from the last class and just the very end of those notes, number 27, because that's where we were, and I'd like to just complete that material on the unity of the human person before we move on into chapter 17. We were in the middle of number 27 last week when it was just time to call a halt because the discussion probably, I felt, would have taken us longer than we had the time to cover. But what the point that Lonergan's making in that section on the unity of the human person, and this is probably the only thing that I'm going to cover here from 16, is number 27. Is that we, human beings, are a combination of matter and spirit. We're material by the physical, the chemical, the biological, and the psychological conjugates or conjugate forms, and spiritual by the intellectual conjugates, by the operations of insight, reflection, critical reflection, judgment, deliberation, evaluation, decision. But we are intelligibly one, not two. And the unity is grounded in the central form. And the question is, where is that central form to be identified? What is it that provides that makes us the unity, concrete unity identity of all? So that's what central form is all about. From a descriptive point of view, he says, it would seem to be that the central form is some kind of point of transition from the material to the spiritual. And this is actually a position that in other very different terms, a lot of psychologies fall into, namely, and you find this in Jung, for instance, that the psyche is the unifying point in the human person. And Jung identifies in the human person body, psyche, and spirit. He does identify all three as distinct dimensions, but he'll place the unification here. And from a descriptive standpoint, it seems that, maybe that's where it should be placed, because this, the psyche shares in the spirit, and it shares in the body, and it seems to mediate the two. Now, I think, obviously, from the stuff that I've tried to write on this, the psyche is an extremely significant dimension that needs to be brought more into the perspective that Wanigan himself has begun. But from the explanatory point of view, where the question is whether our central form is conditioned intrinsically by the empirical residue, and therefore whether what gives us unity, what gives us the status of unity, identity, whole, is itself conditioned by the material in such a way that it is intrinsically constituted by the material, is the question that Lonergan is facing here. And in harmony with the whole tradition that comes out of Thomas, and certainly that has been taught by the church over the course of the last 8-9 centuries, he will come down with the spirit dimension as the sent as providing the central form in the human person. And he'll come down with that in an experiential way, that really it is through our insights and our judgments and our decisions that our personal unity is attained, that we experience ourselves as a concrete unity, identity, whole. It's not through the vagaries of psychic ebbs and flows that we experience the unity of the human person and that we reach our unity. We reach our unity primarily through the decisions that we've made, the self-constituting decisions that we've made that make us the persons that we are to be. It speaks of the existential moment that comes into the lives of all of us, where we realize that it is up to ourselves to decide for ourselves what we are to make of ourselves. And it's in those moments that the unity of the person is experientially constituted. And that is not something that belongs to the stream of sensations, emotions, conations, bodily movements, associations, and so on, that he means and that others mean by the term psyche. That is rather a set of operations that are the self-constituting operations of the existential deciding subject, which he will place in the spirit dimension. So his point there, in other terms, and in ways that we can get a hold of more experientially than the metaphysical terms that he's using here, is that it is the spiritual dimension, it's the operations of the spirit. It's understanding, it's what we hold to be true, it's what we have decided is the right thing for us to do. That's what makes us, that's what gives us our unity. So it is in the spiritual dimension that the central form is to be discovered. And then he has a long metaphysical argument that central form, insight, judgment, decision, or that what is responsible for that, is itself not constituted or intrinsically conditioned by the empirical residue and therefore by prime matter. And if that is the case, then it is capable of surviving the dissolution of the body. And that's all, he's just leaving it there. He's just leaving it there, he's not going on and to talk about eschatology, immortality, and so on. He's just saying that if that is the case, if it is intrinsically not constituted, not intrinsically conditioned by matter, and it is capable of surviving the death, the end of the breakdown of the conjugates at these levels of body and psyche. The I, what says I, remains. There's no further, because you've got to go into theology to carry on anything further than that. Okay, so I'm going to leave the discussion of chapter 16 at that point unless there are any further questions that people want to raise about this or anything else, because I do want to get on into some. Yes?
I have a question that I'm struggling with. Would you please define for me isomorphism?
Yeah, a parallel structure. So isos is equal, it's a Greek, and morphe, form or structure. So isos means equal, morphe means form. So So isomorphism, he will mean, well, the clearest instance of the isomorphism up to this point has been the isomorphism of knowing as experiencing, judging, and deciding, as experiencing, understanding, and judging. And so that those are the acts. There must be a parallel form to the contents of the act. So there must be something that is experienced, something that is understood, something that is affirmed. And he'll name this potency, this form, and this act. But the isomorphism, the theorem of isomorphism is simply that there must be a parallel structure between the parallelism between the structure of the acts and the structure of the contents of the acts. So that's the meaning of the term isomorphism.
So basically he's saying that if the I is known through our decisions, is that what he's saying?
Well, I mean, I added that on there because I think it's a clearer example of the point that he is making, that what constitutes the I in us is at the level of spirit. Up to this point, he hasn't discussed decisions. He's discussed understanding and judgment. Spirit, for him, begins with the question that gives rise to insight in terms of our operations. So we are spirit when we start raising the kind of question that you just raised. The material part of us doesn't raise those questions. It's the spirit that you feel those questions because of the parallel.
I guess what struck me in that is that when you said that it's the spirit part, I kind of felt it's very disembodied. But in a way, it's the spirit in the body.
Also, oh, yeah, it's the spirit. It is the spirit in the body. It's not. There's no question about disembodying it at all. And the very point that the operations of the spirit are also felt in the psyche and can bring about shifts in the body. It shows the unity of the whole thing. But it's just, it's a set of distinctions, not separations. Another way to put it. It's just that the stream of sensations, memories, images, conations, bodily movements, spontaneous intersubjective responses, that's not what asks the question that you just asked. That question comes from some other dimension, some distinct dimension of you. You feel that question, but it's not your feelings that are asking it. It's you as an inquiring person. And in fact, it is your questions and your answers that progressively constitute you as the person that you are. Your questions for understanding, your questions for reflection, your questions for deliberation, and the answers that you give to those. That is what your identity fundamentally comes from. We are born with a rudimentary identity, very rudimentary, but it emerges. Obviously, in our early years, it's largely under the influence of the psychic because we're affected at psychic levels by atmosphere, by family, by mother and father, by siblings, and all of that sort of thing. But when we speak about the emergence at a certain age of the capacity for reason, of the capacity for formal operations, of the capacity for theoretical operations, and so on. And then the more we go on, it's more those things that take over the constituting of who we are. And particularly, and this is a point that he hasn't yet gotten to, it's the questions that we raise with regard to who am I to be and what am I to do. And those questions, there are feelings that can give rise to those questions. And feelings are a large determinant of the criterion of the answers to those questions. But feelings don't make the decision. It's something I make the decision. And what is that I that makes that decision? My feeling will shift as I make the decision. But the feeling is not what actually makes it. That's what he's trying to get at. He's trying to get at the I that makes the decision. Where does that I reside? It's a tough thing to get a hold of. It's not an easy thing.
No, it's not a question of not getting hold of it. It's just that in my personal experience, there are times when it really seems to me that it is from a space that is, it comes to my consciousness, it comes to my intellectual consciousness, but from a space that is deeper than that.
Oh yeah, I don't think there's any question that that's right. I think that is true. Well, the space that, but what is the space that is deeper? I mean, is that there's a spirit dimension to that space that is deeper. And that's the spirit dimension to that space that is deeper that makes the psychic as deep as it is. And why is our psychic resonance so much more expansive than the psychic resonance of the other animals? It's because that psychic resonance is informed by a spirit that is capable of raising and answering questions for understanding judgment. This is the point that he's making here. You don't want to divorce, like, the questions, the levels, there's a difficulty with the spatial metaphor of the levels, because it can seem like you're divorcing one from another, and that you're going up and you're splitting, and that's a problem with this metaphor. I've often said that we've got to try to find a different metaphor, of some kind of circular interrelationship. Levels or something like that, to make it clear that you're not separating. The metaphor gives you some way of distinguishing, but under no conditions is there to be a separation. That's why, you know, frequently it's the arrows up and down that make it clear that there's constant communication here. Why is it that the dreams of a human being sometimes can be so profoundly existential? Now, we don't know what the dreams of a dog are. We know that dogs dream, or at least we have a pretty clear indication, because they'll start barking in their sleep, and they're probably, you know, having dreams of other dogs or whatever. But I doubt that their dreams can have the existential significance that some archetypal or anagogic dreams of human beings have. And it's because the dreaming human being has a depth of spirit to him or her, that where the dream is the emergence of elemental meaning that potentially is constitutive of the personal identity of the person. Chris?
But would it be fair to say that, like, I'm just thinking about, like, on a personal experience level, relating it that way, but that the, it's like the pure desire to know, in so much as that would motivate or drive, you know, motivate knowledge, even the question, who am I? That the very statement of the question, who am I, originates with this drive that intends so much deeper, so much beyond, participates in this, that I am an indication of something that's even greater myself in the simple fact that I bring up the question, you know, in that sense. That would be the depths of what you're saying that you experience, yeah.
And actually, this will come as we get into chapter 17, that the correspondence of the psychic and the intellectual operators and mysteries. So perhaps if we move on, it might actually throw some light on it. Okay, so can we move into the material for 17? 17 is a very complicated chapter. It's one that I think is a major statement in the history of Western philosophy, from my own judgment on it, is that it has yet to be fully appreciated for everything that is in there. We read the first two sections of chapter 17 for this week, and as I say in number one here in the notes, it comes full circle. I mentioned this when we took the chapter 14. Chapter 17 comes full circle on chapter 14, where he was setting out the method of metaphysics. Recall there that in chapter 14, the basic problem in philosophy, certainly as philosophy has evolved to the present day, is the multiplicity of philosophical views. any philosophy, also on Lonergan's view, any philosophy, even one, those that, with which fundamentally he might disagree, can contribute to a clarification of the basic fact of the polymorphism of human consciousness. So that there is no philosophy that is not worth reading in some way. From every one of them, there can be a contribution to this, to clarifying this basic fact of the enormous diversity of possibilities for human consciousness to move into. Now, in this chapter, he's adding that philosophers after Hegel have to have a method that accounts not only for their own views, but also for those of others. That we have to develop a philosophy of philosophies. Hegel has changed the whole scene to that point, where we must, because this is what Hegel did. And Hegel said, in some ways, you can interpret Hegel's whole project as a philosophy of philosophies. It's a philosophy of more than that. It's a philosophy of pre-philosophic and post-philosophic and so on and so forth. But the philosophy of philosophies accounting for the views of others. The two statements from chapter 14 and chapter 17 are related, and so Lonergan will account for the views of others by setting up a genetic and dialectical process, a process from the notion of being that is operative, spontaneously operative in all of us, from that spontaneous notion of being, which is just simply manifested in our asking questions, to the potential totality of ordered viewpoints and successive expressions, a process that is rendered possible because of the polymorphism of consciousness. So what he's saying here is that you can start with the notion of being as unfolding up to this point through, get rid of everything here except experiencing, understanding, and judging, because this is the notion of being. Experiencing, understanding, and judging, raising and answering questions, heading towards being. And in terms of the ever fuller clarification and differentiation of that structure, you can arrive at, you can start with that, and you can move toward a potential totality, potential, I mean, very important word here, of ordered philosophic viewpoints. In other words, the more and the better I understand this structure and everything that enters into that structure, the better able I am to put together an ordered totality of philosophic viewpoints. Because every philosophy will be a function of this process, understood in one way or another, understood correctly or incorrectly, understood more or less fully. Every philosophy is a function of how the philosopher in question understands that process. So that's what he means by a process that goes from the notion of being that is spontaneously operative in all of us. You start with that. And as you unpack it, you eventually can arrive at some kind of heuristic that opens onto the possibilities of what philosophy can be. And that's what he means by the potential totality of ordered viewpoints. Every philosophy will be a function of this structure, how that structure is understood or misunderstood, or how fully it's understood, how carefully it's understood, and so on. It's a major statement. It's one that you'd have to say to him, okay, prove it. But the only proof is, of course, as you try to do it yourself. The chapter will offer then, and this is my interpretation of the chapter, but I think it's ironclad almost now, that in my mind, he's offering an alternative to Hegel in this chapter. Hegel's process is from the concept of being to the absolute idea. That's stated way back on page 2. But what Lonergan has, in contrast to that, is this process from the spontaneous notion of being to the potential totality of ordered philosophical viewpoints. But And if you can catch here the difference, this is not a concept. This notion of being is not a concept. This notion of being is simply the pure desire to know, as it spontaneously functions in all of us. And as it spontaneously functions in all of us, it goes through this process of experiencing, understanding, and judging. There's not a concept here. Or it itself is not a concept. And this is not the absolute idea. This is a potential totality. All he's saying is that all philosophic possibilities can be unraveled from that structure. All philosophy can be unraveled. He's not saying, I've done it. He's saying, you can do it. It can be done. If you want to understand any philosophy, come back to this and see where that philosophy stands with respect to this structure. So it's a potential totality. So Hegel goes from a concept of being to an idea that he claims includes everything. Lonergan goes from an open notion, anticipation, right? So not a formed concept by any means, an open notion of being, to a potential totality. And all he's claiming by talking about a potential totality is that every philosophy can be unraveled from this structure. So you can take any philosophy and bring it back to that structure and understand it in terms of that structure. That's the only claim. It sounds enormous, but in one sense, it's by no means as enormous a claim as Hegel is making, especially on Kojève's interpretation, if Kojève is correct, that Hegel thought that all of philosophy had come to an end when he finished his book. That's a rather inflated conception of this, if that's accurate. Okay, so do we see the difference there? Number two then. The basic statement is the following. Any philosophy. So think of, think of Sartre, think of whoever it is that you're mostly concerned about. Whether actual or possible, will rest upon the dynamic structure of cognitional activity, experiencing, understanding, and judgment, either as correctly conceived or as distorted by oversights and by mistaken orientations. So philosophies will be, in the terms that he introduced earlier in the book, either positional or counterpositional, depending on where they stand with regard to the operations that are involved in that structure. This theorem will not only allow a view of a general similarity of structure between assumptions regarding knowledge and assumptions regarding the known, that's your isomorphism, but also, when it's coupled with appropriate scholarly techniques of interpretation and history, so that you actually read the manuscripts of the other philosophers, it can yield specific understanding of precise problems peculiar to particular places and times, and of the responses that particular philosophers have made to them. I was reading this over again this morning, and I came up with two examples here that have made some kind of an impression on me within the last while. The first one is a theologian, Pannenberg, systematic theology. There's some things that need to be sorted out. If you can sort these out from the very lengthy first chapter of the first volume of Pannenberg, systematic theology. The role of systematic theology for Pannenberg is the truth to establish the truth of Christian doctrine. Now that statement of the role of systematic theology would be very much at odds with Lonergan's understanding of systematic theology, which is to understand a truth that has already been affirmed. Right. So the issue when I was reading Pannenberg is, okay, how do you adjudicate that difference? How do you understand that difference? How do you resolve that difference? So the difference between establish the truth of Christian doctrine for Pannenberg and for Lonergan, understand a truth of doctrine that you have already affirmed, independently of any systematic work, understanding it. Well, you come back to the question of what Vandenberg means by truth and what Lonergan means by truth. Truth for Vandenberg is coherence. Truth for Lonergan is, as we'll see later on probably today, is the correspondence of judgment and reality. So those are two very different things. Coherence is, on the basis of this structure, the function of understanding, not of judgment. So truth for Vandenberg is conceived of in terms of understanding. He does not distinguish judgment from understanding. And ultimately, you've got to say this is an idealist notion of truth. Now, that does not take away a lot of the value of Vandenberg's work. There's a lot of fine stuff in the work. But you see what I'm trying to do here? I'm trying to adjudicate a difference on the basis of this understanding of the structure. Coherence is not a function of judgment. Coherence is a function of insight and conceptualization. And if your notion of truth is that things have to be coherent, then your notion of truth is left at the level of understanding. And if you leave truth at the level of understanding, you are an idealist. You are not broken through to the judgment of the real. So that's one instance where I find help in, well, it's one instance where I would say that the kind of claim that he's making here proves to have some value. The other thing that I was thinking of is Habermas on truth as consensus. And I'm not sure where yet I come down on this, because I'm just reading him again last night, and there's so much in his work that is, I think, extremely valuable, and I find it really challenging. And I was reading his book, I just finished his book last night on reason and religion, a short series of essays that people compiled from different places. And he's very challenging to theologians, and very open and respected, even though he adopts what he himself calls a methodological atheism. That doesn't necessarily mean a personal atheism, but a methodological atheism in his philosophical and social scientific work. But there's his notion of truth, that truth is a function of the consensus that emerges from communicative action. And there is a problem with that, in my view. Consensus is not necessarily truth. Sometimes the true position is the one that is not the majority's position. And then no matter how open the communication has been, there's always a truth is a task. And Habermas is very good on that issue of truth being a task. But again, I think what is lacking is something to do with the place of judgment in this thinking. And this is more hypothetical than with regard to what I just said about Vandenberg, because Habermas is a lot harder to get hold of than Vandenberg in terms of what he's really all about. But I think that to think of truth as primarily a matter of what is arrived at when reasonable human beings reach consensus, well, it depends on what you mean by reasonable and what your criteria are for what establishes reasonableness. And Habermas wants to pull away from a philosophy of consciousness, and so he's not going to want to do this work of investigating what critical reflection is, what the grasp of the virtually unconditioned is, what it means to know that there are no further questions. And he stays away from that kind of analysis. So in a lot of ways, it's a conceptual kind of clarification of things that still is stuck at a level that does not yet balance the distinction of judgment. That's a hypothetical statement. I'm not sure that I'm right on that. But that's why I think Bill Ragg, the person that I mentioned earlier, the Jesuit from St. Louis, who is a recognized Habermas scholar, wants to bring in Lonergan on judgment, but then also wants to bring Habermas to bear on Lonergan in terms of the communicative action that sometimes is required to reach judgment. And I think he's done a very valuable piece of work there. But if Lonergan needs more of an input, more of an emphasis on the community's role in reaching judgment, Habermas himself needs more of what Lonergan has to offer about the dynamics of judgment itself. That's Reig's position. Anyway, I'm just offering those as examples of what this structure can do with regard to the beginning of other philosophies. They're just two that came to me. Anyway, the combination, we're in the middle of number two, this combination, the combination between the general theorem that any philosophy can be understood in terms of that structure and the techniques of reading any philosophy, the specific techniques, the combination of those, again, is the scissors action of an upper and a lower blade. And what Lonergan's trying to do in this chapter is to disengage the upper blade for reading philosophy. What is that upper blade? The lower blade is all the text. It's this text. It's every text that you've got in your room at home. It's every text you've got in the library. Those are all the lower blade, the data. What do you bring to that? Okay, so his concern is with the upper blade, with this structure functioning as an upper blade, the appropriation of that structure functioning as an upper blade. And his claim is that this cognitional analysis provides a single base of operations from which any philosophy can be interpreted correctly. So the combination of the two blades, the upper blade of our minds, the notion of being, and the lower blade of all the data that you're studying, all the books that you read, all the texts and so on, transposes the issue of act and content from abstract deduction, which is what isomorphism still was, to concrete historical process. And it does this as a part of metaphysics, the dialectical aspect of metaphysics. This is my reading of this chapter. But metaphysics now is applied to meaning in this chapter. So the rest of the metaphysics, he's applied it to universal process, physical to chemical, from chemical to biological, from biological to psychological, from psychological to spiritual. Well, within the spiritual, there's a metaphysics of meaning. There's an ontology of meaning, and that's what this chapter is developing. Potency, form, and act with regard to meanings, how meanings emerge. Meanings also are part of generalized emergent probability. So if Hegel's philosophy is a metaphysics of an alleged absolute idea, Lonergan's alternative is a metaphysics that includes an ontology of meaning. I've developed that in chapter 19 of Theology and the Dialectics of History, where I reflect on why the title here is Metaphysics as Dialectic. Anyway, that's enough for that. Questions up to there? That's a general sort of introduction to what he's doing in the chapter. Anything? Let's see what is it clear? The first section then is, in the first section of the chapter, there's offered a genetic and dialectical account of pre-philosophic utterances. So before we get into any of this stuff about being and metaphysics and epistemology and all the questions that are raised by Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and everybody that comes after them, there is a universal form of human utterance that is symbolic, that is commonsensical, but in particular, at this point, he's trying to get at the level of expression that we identify with poetry and myth, ritual, symbol. And he'll use the two expressions of mystery and myth. And he will insist on the necessary survival even after a fully explanatory metaphysics has been achieved, the necessary survival of symbols of the known unknown. So the emphasis on the symbol orients us into the known unknown. In his later work, he'll change his use of the term myth, because myth has come to have a much more positive significance than it has in this chapter. He'll speak rather of symbolic expressions of counterpositions rather than myth. And just acknowledging that myth has come to have, in this chapter, the word myth has a negative connotation. But in general scholarly work, it has come to have a much more, at least neutral, if not positive. Myth is sort of the stories that people tell about what makes them who they are. Well, that's not, there's nothing negative about that. So he rephrases the term, it speaks of symbolic expressions of counterposition, and mystery as symbolic expressions of position. But to grasp the significance of what he's after here, symbol and so on, he distinguishes between, actually, among three dimensions. I've been through this with you once before, rather quickly, but there's the known, what I know. There's a lot that I know. There's a lot that I know I do not know. The known unknown, I know from all the questions that I have that I cannot answer. It's unknown because I can't answer them. But it's known because I'm raising these questions. These are explicit questions that I'm raising. So explicit questions to which I have to answer, I don't know. So if I've got explicit questions, or you ask me a question and I say to you, I don't know, that's part of my known unknown. Right? It's unknown, I don't know, but I know that I don't know it. So it's a known unknown. And then there is, for all of us, a vast realm, I would presume, of the unknown unknown. A vast realm that we can't even ask questions about. No questions even possible. Now, a person's horizon is a function of what the person knows and what the person knows that he or she does not know. Your horizon is a function of the known and the known unknown. But the unknown unknown is outside your horizon. This comes into your horizon because you're asking about it and you're interested in it. And even if you're not interested in it, you're aware of the question, because it can be brought to your attention. And even if you say, I don't care, it's still part of the known unknown. And it's still part of your horizon because it's within your potential field of vision. And then outside of that is the unknown unknown. So horizon, and this is a term that Lonergan began to use shortly after the publication of Insight and from the reading of Husserl. How does he make use of Husserl's notion of horizon? He makes use of it in his own category by saying, well, your horizon is constituted by what you know plus what you know you don't know. Because that's all within your ken. It's all within the potential range of your vision. Well, it's all within the actual range of your vision. The unknown unknown is within the potential range. It could. Things that are in this can move into this and then move into this. The boundaries here are ever shifting. The unknown unknown that you may wake up tomorrow morning and somebody will tell you something that you never even knew had any point, and you never had any question about it. Now you got a question about it, it moves into you. It's become part of your horizon. So the unknown unknown can move into the known unknown, and the known unknown into the known. So it's not that these are fixed, they're very flexible boundaries here. All right. Why does he bring this in? It's to grasp the significance of symbol. That's why he's bringing it in at this point. To grasp the role of symbol in human life. Because our questions outnumber our answers, we know of an unknown through our unanswered questions. Now, there is a principle of correspondence between psyche and spirit. So there must be, at the psychic level, something that corresponds to this open question at the level of spirit. There must be, at the level of affect, of feeling, some kind of cosmic orientation into the darkness of the known unknown. Our questions outnumber our answers, but by the principle of correspondence, we can relate otherwise coincidental manifolds on the psychic level to higher integrations on the intellectual level, acknowledging that because each level is system on the move, it's not only an integrator, but also an operator. And what the point that he's trying to make is there's got to be some kind of corresponding operator on the psychic level to the question as operator on the intellectual level. And it's in the realm of the symbol. It's in the realm of symbol, of open affect, that corresponds to the openness of the question that we will find the psychic operator, the operator of psychic development. If the intellectual desire to know, if the intellectual operator, pardon me, is the desire to know, oriented to the known unknown, the corresponding psychic operator must be some intimation, some cosmic dimension, some intimation of unplumbed depths, some psychic sense of sense here, in the literal sense of interior sensation of being that accrues to feelings, emotions, sentiments, so that we can simply, at times, we're just taken up with the wonder of it all at an affective level. Wonder is not simply a matter of the head asking questions. Wonder is something that is felt through the entire person. So there's some intimation, some sense that there's something, a depth of mystery. And that sense corresponds to the openness of the question at the level of intellect. By the same principle of correspondence, there will be on the psychic level two spheres of variable content, namely the familiar and the strange. The familiar is what is known. The strange is what we know we can't figure out. We call it weird sometimes. Okay? Mystery and myth find their primary field in the affect-laden images of the unexplored and strange, in the image as symbol linked with the known unknown, and as sign linking the image with some interpretation. So all of the much of what we find in the realm of myth, of ritual, of the mystery cults, of religion, of the occult, everything in this grab bag somehow related to this realm of the unexplored and strange that corresponds on the psychic level to the known unknown. So some interpretations of that strange, unexplored realm, some of them are religious. Some of them are anti-religious. Some of them are humanistic. Some of them are naturalistic. Some of them are neurotic. Some of them are psychic. And the issue is, how do you sort them out? Where is finality heading? Because the sense of the unknown is a psychic resonance to this dynamism heading towards being. How do you sort out that psychic resonance? How do you sort out what appears there? How do you sort out what the different messages that you get from different people if you talk to people about this realm of your own life and existence? How do you sort out who's a good spiritual director from one who doesn't know what he or she is talking about? How do you know if somebody's giving you a myth in the pejorative sense, and someone is leading you into mystery in the positive sense of that term? The whole issue of discernment that he's talking about here. How do we discriminate these psychic resonances? The answers to this question, the answer to the question of where is finality heading, is it heading toward what we have called God? Is it heading toward community? Is it heading towards national? And many of the answers to that question, religious people would call idolatrous. Many of the answers that have been given. Heinemann speaks of the answers that emerged in Nazi Germany, for instance, the crude naturalistic nationalism he refers to as an answer to the question of the meaning of the psychic resonances of the unexplored and strange. Some of those answers are what a politician will call demonic. But the answers are countless. He's not treating those answers yet. He will treat some of them in chapter 20. But first of all, he's got to introduce the question of whether proportional being is all there is. But a philosophy that reaches explicit self-knowledge and metaphysics has got to be able to comment on mystery and myth, not only as past realities, as though we've gone beyond them, but as present realities associated with finality, especially on their relation to the finality exhibited in the very emergence of explicit metaphysics, because they had a role to play in the emergence of explicit metaphysics. There was a lot of mythic consciousness in Greece when philosophy arose, and a lot of the philosophy arose as a reaction against what philosophers like Empedocles came to see as what Lyman's calling mythic consciousness or superstition. So I don't know if I've done too much of a roundabout way or am I making it clear what's going on here? I had a lunch with somebody the other day, and this fellow is a practicing psychotherapist in the city. And there were some things that he told me in the course of the lunch and in a subsequent email that I thought of right away in terms of this kind of thing. How do you sort out what some people are telling you? I'm not going to say what he told me because it's getting too personal and pointed about self-revelation, but the context of his remarks it was something that I, on subsequent reflection, and I'll still have to give it further reflection, but it was something that came from a horizon that I would have to say is not what Lonergan would be calling the psychic sense of mystery that goes along with the orientation towards the known unknown, but that comes from some kind of limitation of that, some kind of a mythic, in the pejorative sense of that term, limitation that has been placed on. There's a lot of this in the New Age is a mixed bag. You go into a place like the Omega Center, which I did the other day, there's a lot of good stuff in there. Gendlin's focusing stuff is in there. There's nothing at all that is mythic in this pejorative sense about what Gendlin's doing. But there's a lot of stuff like numerology, for instance. Okay. I mean, what the heck is this? And how do they make these judgments? In numerology, if I add up... anyway, some kind of combination of these numbers, this is my birthday, June 20th, 1939. Some combination of those numbers gives me 30/3. I forget exactly how you get 30/3. And they've got an analysis in there of everybody who's 30/3. And I went, because somebody told me, you got to get into this numerology stuff. It's really exciting. Well, I went and read what 30-3 it was. Well, it's stuff that could be said about a lot of people, And it has nothing specifically specific identity, if I may use Dugoski's phrase, that indicates anything. So, any question? Or?
Yeah.
No, you add 1 + 9 + 2 + 9 + 6 + 4 = 13.
The tree?
I haven't figured that out.
So, but how do you adjudicate that?
What's
going on? What he's trying to do in this chapter is to disengage something of what might be going on in that kind of a mentality. What in the world is the evidence for that sort of conclusion?
I'm big into neurology in Kentucky.
I think so, yeah.
So,
big neurologist on the farm.
And you're watering it.
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Thanks.
Okay, I think we better take our break.
I'll be doing tarot card readings outside if anyone's interested.
Well, this is what he's talking about in this whole chapter. It's all of this stuff. And how do you adjudicate it? How do you sort it out?
You gotta go for the insights, right?
What's that website for the numerology?
I knew you'd be interested in
we can check ours during the break.
Just type number.
Somebody quickly run up to Omega Center. It's by a man by the name of Milner, M-I-L-L-N-E-R. But I couldn't believe it. But this guy was so excited about it. Anyway, let's take 10 out of the
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Ye